Hi, I'm Sarah Mendelson, and welcome to CSIS. We're very pleased to have with us Osna Seristad today. You know, it's hard in Washington to get people focused on the North Caucasus, let alone Chechnya. So any chance we get, we take the opportunity. Before we hear from Osna, let's just go around the room and say who we are.
Marjorie Mandelstam-Balzer, Georgetown University.
My name's Alex Van Oss. I teach Caucasus Area Studies at the Foreign Service Institute.
My name is Paula London. I work at the International Foundation for Electoral Systems.
Hi, my name is Anthony Bowyer. I'm Program Manager for the Caucasus and Central Asia, also at the International Foundation for Electoral Systems.
Hi, my name is Anna Rochovansky. I'm with the Chechnya Advocacy Network.
I'm Lucy Moore with CSIS.
Hi, my name is Adriana Lawson. I'm with Freedom House.
Jonathan Weber with Freedom House.
Ella Swin with the American Committee for Peace in the Caucasus, also Freedom House.
And I'm Hillary O'Connor with the American Red Cross.
Matt Malarkey, CSIS.
Daniel List, CSIS.
My name is Aslan. I'm from Chichester and in an internship in the U.S.
I want to thank Freedom House for collaborating with us on this and for facilitating Osna's trip here. So without further ado, Osna.
Thank you. I don't know where to start. Definitely, I don't need to introduce the Caucasus to you. I have very different audiences when I travel on a book tour. Sometimes it's in a library, sometimes in a bookstore, where that's what you need to do. But here, obviously, that's not necessary. But I wonder, to what extent has anyone read the book? So that I just okay. So quite a few have read the book, and then that's good to know. And then I'll just do a brief introduction of myself, or is that
sure.
Necessary? Yeah. Well, I'm from Norway. my name is Osna Seristad, and I started off as a correspondent in Russia. So I majored in Russian language at the University of Oslo, and my first great love of Russia was the literature. And that's also the first time I heard about Chechnya. As you know, it's a great motive in among several Russian writers. Then in the mid-90s, I moved to Moscow, and I started to... Well, first I studied political science in Moscow, and then I started to work as a freelancer, as a correspondent for a Norwegian newspaper. And that's where I were when we saw on television Russian tanks rolling over the border into Chechnya. 94, New Year's, around New Year, and I lived in a Russian family at the time, and I thought that I could cover this from Moscow. I never expected to see myself in a war. That was never my intention to go there. But then, of course, after a while, as war develops, and as you know, with the war comes the propaganda and the lies, and one interesting point too is that if we remember back the in 1995 when I went for the first time, this was the days before the internet, mobile phones. Maybe you had internet in Washington D.C. I don't know, but we did not have that in Moscow, and it didn't work like today, where you can click onto the web and you see hundreds of different sources of what is happening different places of the world. So my sources in Moscow, it was Russian television, which was very different from today. Like, there was still a lot of debate and different opinions. There was some TV station in favor of the war, against the war, or in favor of the government, against the government. And there was a great debate in the papers and among the people. But still, I realized I had to go there for myself. And as a young freelancer without any money, I could not hire a car, or there were no planes going. Trains stopped going into the region, of course, with the war. And I realized that the only people that were still going, that was the Russian army itself. So I went to the Ministry of Defense in Moscow and asked if I could get a seat on a transport plane or on a troop transporter. And they said, yes, there's a plane after tomorrow at 5 o'clock from leaving from military airport of Domodedovo, and you can get a seat, you can get a lift down to Grozny. So this is also just to tell you a little bit of the mid-90s in Russia, reign of Boris Yeltsin. Everything was possible, and one can say that Russia was bureaucratic, but it was very easy to break through that bureaucracy. And so that was the time when they didn't really care so much about nor what the Russian media reported nor what the foreign media reported. So we were very free in our movements around in Chechnya. Sometimes, or most of the time, we spent time with the civilians trying to hunt down the different guerrilla leaders. As long as they were still alive, they were killed one after the other. And we did get to see them then, Dudayev, Maskhadov, these different leaders. And then also we reported from, when I say we, it's like I usually traveled in group of 2-3 journalists. We also reported on the Russian side of the life of the Russian soldiers in this conflict. Then I went back and forth several times during the first Chechen war. After Yeltsin had secured the elections in 96, I left Russia, and like most of the world, most of the other journalists, we turned away from Chechnya and we kind of forgot about it. I moved on to the Balkans, where I wrote my first book. It's called With Their Backs to the World. It's also available in English from Serbia. Then September 11th, went to Afghanistan, later wrote The Bookseller of Kabul, and from there to Iraq, wrote another book, 101 Days. And then in 2005, I was actually moving. I moved to Ohio, of all places, to write a book about small town America, which I found, asked myself, what is the most important thing now in the world? That was 2005, and I was thinking that is to try to understand what's happening in the United States. And that's why I moved to Ohio. But at some point that fall, I went home to Norway, and I, by coincidence, I saw a movie that's called Three Rooms of Melancholy. It's a Finnish movie, and it's about Russian children and Chechen children. And I was totally devastated watching this movie. And going home, I realized that I had to quit this American project and go back to Chechnya. It's then been 10 years since I'd been there. And the reason for that is was that I suppose I got these people and the first war I covered, I got it in a way under my skin, so I couldn't really. And I lived with a little, some kind of a bad conscience that I'd forgotten, and I knew about the terrible things that were happening in Chechnya, but I never went back and I never went into it. And I, so going, walking home then from this movie theater in Oslo, I was kind of filled with a sense of duty. And I don't mean that journalism should be led by duty. We would get very moralistic reporting, but sometimes that is what it is. And I felt that now that I do have a voice, I have an audience, I have readers, I should do something important. And it's not that United States is not important. It might still be the most important thing to understand, but it's like there are so many books on the U.S., and I don't think my book would have made a difference. So I decided to go back, and that's what I did in January of 2006, first to Moscow and already there. And I hadn't been back to Russia for 10 years. And already in Moscow, I see all the great changes that this country had undergone since mid-90s. And you just need to turn on the television, and you see that. And as you know, television in 2006 and later, it's purely Putin's news. Whatever he's done that day is covered with great interest on the TV, and there's no criticism whatsoever against him or the government. Another thing that was very much changed since the mid-90s was relationship to Chechnya. This time, I found out that I was not allowed to go to Chechnya unless I went in a group organized by the Russian authorities for a few days with hand-picked interviews, and they would show us what they wanted to show us. And, of course, for a book, that is, you can't make a book that way, so I had to find another way down. And the only way to really try to get some real stories out of Northern Caucasus was to go in disguise. So I dressed up like a Chechen woman with a headscarf and Chechen dresses, coats, like high heels, makeup, and accompanied with by another Chechen woman. She also told me how to look. She was telling me not to smile so much, not to look curiously around, but to look down and frown. That would be how a Chechen woman would appear on an airport and traveling. So we went this way. I went several times back and forth, and I was actually never caught. We flew in from Moscow to one of the neighboring republics, changing around a bit, and then crossing the border by car. And as these are internal borders, very often they don't check everybody, all the passengers in the car. They would, the Russian block posts or other block posts, they would check the driver, maybe the boot of the car, and if you're a woman in the back of the car with a headscarf, and we put these little baskets of apples and tomatoes as if we'd just been on the nearby market. I was never checked. And if I had been, I don't know, because I didn't have any documents to prove that I was Chechen. So I didn't. I thought that was going too far to get false documents. So I was just never checked. So that was the possible way to go to Chechnya in 2006, 2007. So very different than from 95 when we could hitchhike down with the Russian army. And this is one of the main differences between those two presidents, Putin and Yeltsin, that Putin understood something that Yeltsin didn't seem to care about, the power of the free word. So he controlled not only the Russian journalists, but even the foreign journalists. So I think one reason why it's hard to get attention on Chechnya is that the fact that it's really hard to get there. And then every journalist very often will kind of weigh what you can get out of the story. And at this time, now it's not so dangerous anymore, but from 2000 on and up till today, it's been very dangerous to go. But you don't really, you risk your life, but you don't really get the credit for it, as you would if you went to Iraq or Afghanistan. And I suppose you would also have lots of editors in the newspapers. When this is off the agenda, they wouldn't send journalists to risk their lives in such an area. And when there is no press and no coverage, it's very hard to get attention, obviously. And in addition to that, many of the best journalists having reported on Chechnya have been denied visas to Russia. You have Carlotta Gall, Thomas Duval, you have Danish journalist Vibeke Spelling, I'm sure you have a lot others. Who have usually the reason they say is that they have broken the laws of the Russian Federation by being in Chechnya illegally, like I did. So, of course, when you have the best journalists or the with the most knowledge about this area banned from Russia, and that is the best way into Chechnya, or maybe even the only way into Chechnya these days, it's difficult to get any coverage. So when I went there then in disguise, I first wanted to write a book about the abuses of human rights, people that were still disappearing, tortured in jails or even in the private jails of Kadyrov. And I went around first with representatives from Memorial, which, of course, you all know. The We went to see families, I was in their offices reporting on people to come in, telling about the missing relatives and so on. The problem was that when we, as I was there, not officially, I had to be very careful. So when we went to visit families that themselves were being surveilled, of course, we couldn't stay long. It's very often we went to families and could spend like 2 hours, 3 hours, go back. And I was told, now you never go back because now those neighbors have seen you, and if you come again, they will be, they might, you know, be suspicious or something. So I ended up with lots of stories of people that I've had seen for a few hours, and it didn't differ much from what you could read in a report from Amnesty or report from Memorial, and they already do these reports, and I was going to make a book, and I couldn't really make a literary Amnesty report, so it was very difficult to see how can I make a book out of this when I couldn't really spend enough time. And I was about to give up, and I spent 6 months on this human rights angle. After 6 months, when I was thinking this doesn't work at all, it was also in this kind of reporting, there's a lot of waiting. Like, you have to wait for someone to go down with you. I can never go there alone. You have to wait for someone who will house you in Chechnya. And so it's like there was a lot of frustrating waiting in Moscow. But then after half a year, I was thinking, I need a different angle into it. And then I was remembering this, the first film that inspired me, this film about the children. And I was thinking, and this was Children of an Orphanage, and I was thinking that could be, why don't I just go back to that basic idea that made me go back to Chechnya at all. And I did some research about the orphans of Chechnya, and I heard there was a few state orphanages at the time, and there was this one private orphanage. That's the one I contacted because, of course, a state orphanage I couldn't visit without any documentation of any kind you needed to, in order to be in Chechnya, first you needed, as a foreigner, accreditation from the Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs, the journalistic accreditation. Then you needed, in addition to that, a KTO accreditation from the Ministry of Internal Affairs, and KTO stands for Kontraterroristiska Operacja, so it's in zones of counter-terror operations, which was really hard to get. So, of course, without any of this, I couldn't be in a state orphanage in Chechnya. And I contacted the private orphanage, I met the woman who runs it, and I first went to visit the orphanage, part of it that lives in Lithuania. Half of the children are there, and then later I went down to Grozny, and I kind of moved in with this orphanage. And from there is also the title of the book, The Angel of Grozny, that is this woman who has been called, or is being called the Angel of Grozny. She has saved so many people since mid-90s and up to till today. Street children moving in. Later she went out in the markets and ruins and streets and riverbanks to find children to take care of. And I don't know if I should get so much into the details of that story, because I don't want to speak for too long. Then we can rather have a discussion at some point. But I can tell you, like, the frames of the book. It's because I realized that for a book, this was the right story to tell. It's a harrowing story of what happens to children in a war. It's a story of post-traumatic stress, of abuse, of fear, of what happens to children who are living through war the way that the Chechen children have. And For the book, I've picked out a few children that I follow throughout the book, and then I go, so that is like the main story, and then in and out from that, there's also the visits to the more human rights angle of the disappeared, of the killed, of the mothers who lost all their children. And that's also the opposite, or maybe the same side of the story here. There's a few mothers in the book that have lost 5 out of 6 sons. So you have the mothers without children, and you have the children without parents. And I could... I see the American edition, they've chosen a very violent cover here. I didn't really approve of this cover, but it actually, it is anyway, it is quite telling in a way, because one of the main characters in the book, is his name is, or I've given him the name Timur. All the children have, I gave them new names. So they cannot be identified, because so that when they grow up, they can themselves decide which part of their past they want to tell about. So this boy Timur, when the book starts, he is he's 12 years old, and we meet him. And this first part is written like a novel or like a short story. We meet him. He's on a riverbank. He's there, and it's all based on what he's told me. So I was not there with him, but he's told me afterwards. He lived on the riverbank. He built himself a little shack, and he spent his days, as he said, killing. And what does a 12-year-old kill? Well, he kills stray dogs and cats and pigeons and insects and of all sorts. And I asked him, well, how do you kill dogs? And he explained how he got his very weak, thin street dogs in Grozny, and he got them to come to him, and he was hiding this brick in his hand and killed them by throwing it in their skulls. And he told me that that was the only way to feel strong, calm, and invincible. That was his words. And of course, if that is what you need to feel calm, one can just imagine what he's gone through, and that is also his telling. He lost his father, who was a fighter, then his mother, then his grandparents, and then he moved in with some relatives who abused him. Then he ran away, got back to other relatives, where he, because he doesn't have a very, how to say, nice boy's behavior either. So that is also one of these problems in the orphanage, that these children, even that they now get care, it's not enough to just give them a warm bed and a cup of milk and they will be fine, because they're so haunted and they still have the war inside of them. So this Timur, at least as long as I was there, he was breaking windows and throwing away things. He was fleeing. He was beating up the smaller children. So it's all these kind of behavior that turn people against him. And I asked him, why do you do all these things? And he said that I'm evil. And I asked him, what do you mean by evil? And he said, I have this fire of evilness inside of me. And I asked him, is there anything you can do to get rid of that evilness? And he thought about it, and he said, well, if I kill everybody who's ever been bad to me, I'll get rid of my evilness. So that is also how he sees that a problem like that, his own problem, can be solved by violence. And he is growing up, as you know, in a place of, in a culture even of violence, and in a place filled with violence. And he's now 14 years old, and the book, as you understand, with these orphans, it's there's no real ending to the book. It does end. I start with him, and I end with his sister. But there's no real, where the book ends is like, it's the situation is more or less the same as it was when I was there. So it's his sister, that is, these are the two main characters. Same past, including sexual abuse, So she is also has very hard times adapting, and she's not violent like he is, but she can't stop stealing. So she steals everywhere. She was forced out in the streets to steal from the markets and from shops by relatives, and now she can't stop it. So she steals like every money she sees or food. She hides it or she gives it away. Little ribbons from her schoolmates and classmates and pencils. And it's just like the brother, or including other children in the orphanage, just like kind of always kind of screaming for attention, but they're only able to get this negative attention in a way. And another thing with her is that, and with several of the children, and that we read about, one of the first things that goes with children of post-traumatic stress would be concentration, ability to learn, ability to concentrate. And only really living close to these children, I understood why, or I better understood why. And I was doing homework with them. And I remember with this girl, Liana, she's 13 years old, and we were doing equation, mathematics, quite like, you know, Russian level, 13 years old. It's quite difficult, actually. This is the Russian school system they go in now. And she didn't understand, and I tried to, like, do it easier and easier. And in the end, we were like, A is 2 minus 1. And I asked her, how much is that? And she's like, 2. And I was like, no, 2 minus 1. And she was 3. No, 2, you have 2, and you give away 1, what do you have? And then, yeah, 1. So I just realized that she doesn't understand numbers on the paper. It's like... she's just lost that ability, and same with then we were doing with her English lessons, and we went back to the first lesson of the book, doing desk, dog, bag, cat, and after like 500 times, still she would be where we. When we started, and she asked me, when we did this, she asked me, how come I can't remember anything? How come I can't learn? And she was really angry at herself, like, why can't I learn anything? And I just said, without really thinking about it, I said, you know, there's probably so much you need to forget that you've lost, you can't, it's hard for you to remember anything. And she then burst out crying, and then I realized how close I was to the truth here. That these children, or at least the worst off children, they've spent all their energy to forget, not to remember, all their energy to just shovel away, for things not to stick. And suddenly they're back in school after the war, and they're supposed to remember things. And they lost that ability to remember, or at least some of these children. So these are the new generation of Chechnya. Of course, you have also in this orphanage and around Chechnya, you have children who adapt well and who go to school and who learn. But these are the most vulnerable ones. And from there, I will go over to, because I also had an official part of my visit, because when I finished the story, I also wanted to report on the regime, on to get to know Ramzan Kadyrov, and to write about the winners of this place. And of course I couldn't do that at the same time, even though it was just about across the street. I had to go back to Moscow and apply for all these visas and accreditation that I needed. So because when I was in the orphanage, when I got there, we drew in a car, we drew open the gate, and we drew into the backyard. As you know, the Chechen houses, they have all of them high walls and high gates, drove in, and then only would I get out of the car. And then if we were leaving somewhere, I would go into the car again in the backyard, and then we would drive around. So I didn't really walk around in the streets or talk to people, and even the neighbors of the war fronts didn't ever see me. And then the official part, I got this invitation from the Chechen government. I said I was honest about that I was writing a book, and I wanted to interview Ramzan Kadyrov. And I was called up by the Chechen government to kind of, ask me a few questions. What kind of, I had to fax down a list of questions. And then they actually did invite me, and they picked me up at the airport in Grozny. So for the first time, I actually flew directly into Grozny on a real visa. And they picked me up, and I got a flat, a flat in a opposite the corridor of the Prime Minister of Chechnya, and in the government compound, almost like some kind of a green zone in light of Grozny, guarded by Russian soldiers. Where the government, the parliament, these institutions are. And I did three trips because I didn't get the interview with Kadyrov until the very end. So I was waiting around, and it was like he was not in the mood, who knows. And it was kind of strange how I was always dealing with this, the prime minister, he would be as if Kadyrov was so hard to catch down, like maybe today, maybe tomorrow, maybe tomorrow morning. It can happen any time, whenever he wants. So they were kind of building him up like this almost like this guerrilla leader, hard to catch. But I was always around the president because I was invited to all kind of events, like he was opening up the stadium, the sports stadium, running around, I would be there, or he had a celebration at his house, I was there, but I was not allowed to approach him or talk to him. Or they were celebrating remembering his father's death day at his uncle's house, praying. I could very much observe him. And then only in the end, I got the interview. It's a whole chapter. And it's very much just off the tape, because you don't really need to... he's enough in himself, maybe some of you have read the interviews that Anna Politkovskaya did with Kadyrov a few years earlier, where he is he's not very articulate, he's threatening her, like, we'll come after you, he doesn't seem to care what kind of impression he gives, and he wants to scare her and to scare people. And he has changed in a way. He's more, I wouldn't say if he's more articulate, but he's more, he's gone some courses, I think, with some Russian media advisors. So he was in a good mood, just his perspectives and references would be very telling of a man who's got his few years of schooling and have lived a life of a soldier and a lifeguard. So I don't know if I should pick some examples, but it's from the interview. For instance, when it comes to... I asked him about, of course, the accusations against him, suspicions that he'd been behind the murder of Politkovskaya, and he would just sit back and laugh, and he said, in Chechnya, we don't kill women, we love them. And she should have stayed in her kitchen. Things like that. And I asked him about the value of women. I tend to ask very open questions. because then you get whatever the person is actually thinking about. So ask, what is, how do you see the value of women in the Chechen society? And he said, the value of women is really falling and it's very bad, and you human rights people, you should care about this more. Why don't you care more about the value of women? Because now, and he mentioned like in Dagestan where they have prostitutes, now you could get a prostitute for $20 and earlier it was $100. So the value of women for him is like, it was the street value, and that was his references when I asked about the value of women. And he's very much now taking Chechnya back to, or he wants to take it back to a much more traditional way of living. And he told me how women should behave, wear headscarves. He's given out, like, now you can't get into the University of Grozny without wearing a headscarf if you're a woman. There are guards there, especially assigned for that. And just also would maybe I'd like to mention about the international criticism, how he responded to that. He said, let them criticize. And that's a little bit probably some of your problems. Also dealing with Russia, that nor Chechnya, but not even Russia seems to care much about the accusations of the breaches of human rights that's happening in the region or in the rest of Russia. It's foreigners, let them talk, they don't know the situation well, and who are they to tell us how to run the place. And Kadyrov said, how come these foreigners believe that they care more about the Chechens than I do, who is the leader of Chechens? So that was the rhetorics. I also, as this was three long trips of official trips, also a lot of waiting around, but I was then spending time with his people, and his government he has got this. Part of the book is with the young people from this ministry, the youth ministry. And these are the, because there are also some winners in the Chechen society. Because if you want to do a career, if you want to get rich, if you want to have a job in administration or anything, you need to be on the side of Kadyrov. There's no real other way to make a career, and you have all these nice, well-dressed young Chechens who are running an organization very much like the Komsomol, organizing events, and every month there's a big event, and they spend every month, as you will see from the book, preparing the next event, whether it's Kadyrov's birthday, his 100 days of reign, whether it's his father's death, the day of his death, it's, and all Russian celebrations like Day of Independence, Day of the Nation. And now their main concern was to raise a statue of Khrushchev in the middle of Grozny, because he had been the one to get the Chechens back from Kazakhstan. And all their actions were very much run by the government, but you got this this frenzy of happy-looking people who were celebrating, having concerts and celebrations to make like this happy image of Chechnya. And I realized that students and people working in government institutions, they had to come to these events and cheer, and they were given flags and T-shirts and hats. If not, they would either get some kind of, in university, they would get some kind of punishment. They were crossed off from list by their teachers, and the same in the workplaces. So it's hard to know what kind of support Kadyrov has. But I think he, at some point, it's hard to tell, of course, but I think he does have some kind of support too, because for many people, they're just tired of the war, of the fighting, and now there is, on the surface, some kind of stability. But then you have the other side. You have people who still are beaten up, who are taken, are arrested, disappear. And in my book, there's one of the boys of the orphanage who's then in his early 20s, who's taken in by Chechen authorities, beaten up and tortured, and asked whether he know this and this and this person, just the typical way, either to just scare off or if they have some suspicions of someone. But very often it's just to kind of pacify the society that you pick up suspicious-looking young men and just scare them and beat them up and threaten them. And he met then with Memorial, and they told him, you should go, you should leave. Once you've been taken into this organization, this state organization, they will come after you. They will never forget you. Once they've taken you, they will take you again, and you'll never, you'll never be like free after this. And actually, 1 week ago, they went back to take him. And he's now in Argun in a prison there for several days. We didn't know where he was, and he was taken by 12 Kadyrovtsi, came to the orphanage and took him, and that's what we know when Memorial is working on his case. And as I know him, of course, just by living there, and I can't say what he has done or not has. But he's a little bit of a homebody, and he is now he's the male head of the orphanage, because it's the Angel of Grozny, the woman who lives in Grozny, and then it's her husband living in Lithuania, taking care of the other orphans there, because he had to flee Chechnya as well. So that could be a reason why he's taken, but most of the time he is at home. He doesn't really, he's never fought. And so that is the last news of the family of this book. I think I will just stop there, and if there are any comments, I'm sure many of you know a lot more of what's happening there right now, so I'd also love to hear from you. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. You've provided just a wonderful view into a region of Russia that is generally poorly covered, but also you've given a perspective of victims that have also been, by and large, either forgotten or their voices aren't heard very much. The last time we met a couple weeks ago, we were showing a documentary by a Swiss filmmaker that was about Anna Polkovskaya, and one of the heroines in the documentary, other than Anna, was the Chechen head of an orphanage. And at the time of the filming, which was a year ago, she was running this private orphanage as well in Grozny, but she's now in political asylum in Switzerland. And so, you know, one worries that there just are not the kinds of social services, let alone psychological resources, for these kids. And, you know, this is a program on human rights and security we're particularly interested in. The security implications of human rights abuse, and that's as much human security and how you experience it as it is on the state level. So I think your book is important for donors, for anybody who's working to deliver resources on the ground, and to remind them that they need to put as a priority this next generation and these young people. Which you almost never hear about in any kind of policy speeches. The other thing just to comment on before opening it up to your questions, I recently had a colleague who had been invited by the Russian government to Valdai, this Valdai discussion group, and they had gone down to meet Mr. Kadyrov. And the contrast of your depiction and this colleague's discussion, the one thing that was similar was the discussion of the people that are surrounding Kadyrov, that there are these sort of well-dressed young bureaucrats who seem to be intent on presenting Chechnya in a certain way. The description of every month they're working on logistics to have some other kind of event to generate more of this, I thought was particularly interesting. Why don't we open it up for your questions, should you have any?
And what impression, when you say it was very different, what impression did they get from him?
This colleague was mostly talking about how Grozny is an entirely different city, that when they landed, they were struck by the tremendous rebuilding that had gone on, that essentially any scars of the war were gone, this idea that there was complete rebirth in Chechnya, and that and when they sat down to meet with Kadyrov, he was the whole impression was of being in control, and the war was put to the side. But it was as if there were no continuing disappearance, there was no torture, there were no orphanages, and that the history of Chechnya was beginning anew. So the way in which they were reconciling with the past was essentially to completely paper it over. But, you know, I think this is also, on the one hand, this colleague understood that they were part of a PR experiment. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, the experiment seemed to be working on some level. I mean, there wasn't a lot of, to me, self-reflection on what this meant or why they were there. Or was there anything beyond what they were being shown? So are there any specific questions for us there?
Or comments.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Have you gotten any reaction from Russia to your book? I mean, you mentioned that journalists in the past have had, been banned. I'm sure that your book would elicit the same reaction if it is read. And also sort of how, I mean, it seems like with Chechnya being so much determined by the Russian regime, are you at all interested in getting this kind of story to the Russian people in any format? I mean, so both government-wise and in terms of people there.
Do you have a Russian publisher for the book?
For this book, I have a Russian publisher for the book Several Couple, so that's out in Russian. For this book, I have been also quite careful because the angel of Grozny, or Khadijat Kataeva, she said that, you know, you can translate this book to all countries if you like, and she approved of her quotes. That are important for me to note that she and her husband approved of their quotes all through the book. Took out a few, not to seem too critical, but she said, I don't want it in Russian because I don't want the government here to be able to read it. Of course they can read it if they speak English, but it's not something regular Russians will read. And I think somehow that if it's in Russian, who would read it? Well, you get probably some state agencies who will read it, and then you get the people from Memorial and Human Rights. So it's like you either get the readers who already know, or you get the readers that you don't want to have. So I haven't really, I don't think, and I wonder if my publisher, Amphora, in St. Petersburg, whether they would actually, or whether they could actually translate a book, which is that, not only critical, but the fact that it's about Chechnya, and critical about Chechnya. So Russian reactions would be, the only reactions I know are from the Russian embassy in Oslo, and it was a debate, and I was invited by the University of Oslo. It's a student debate, and I was invited. There was a representative of the Helsinki Committee invited, and then they also wanted to invite the Russian embassy, a representative from the Russian embassy. And at the beginning of the debate, they read up the answer from the Russian embassy saying that we will not participate in a debate with such people as then myself and also this person from Helsinki Committee. So official, but also looking down on our way at us, like these were people we wouldn't even like sit next to. So I wonder what would have happened if I did apply for a visa, which I have not. So I haven't tried to see, am I banned from Russia or not? But again, I probably would never be able to work there. If I booked a tour to St. Petersburg, maybe I would get a visa, I don't know. But there haven't been any official reaction other than this from the debate. And again, I believe it seems very much they don't really care. The Russia today is very self-assured. They have fights with much more important and powerful figures than me, and they don't care about that criticism, and they would not care about my criticism. And that's also, like, when I started to write the book, I was thinking, I need to write a book so that Europe opens its eyes and we'll see. And so I was very ashamed of my own government in Norway, the fact that we only care about oil contracts in the north. We don't criticize the human rights situation in Russia. But then having written the book, I realized that the situation is much more complex. And what could Norway do? And I did send the book, and I gave the book to the Norwegian ministry, the Norwegian Minister of Foreign Affairs, Jonas Gahr Støre. And he read it over Christmas, and he sent me a note that it was powerful but terrible book. I asked him, I would be happy to have a discussion about it. And I didn't get an invitation for that. But I know that he is aware of the facts. He is aware. He's read the book. He's read other books. He knows about this. But what can he do? Because to just, tell the Russians how to behave, that doesn't really seem to help. And I was also invited by the Swedish Minister of Foreign Affairs, Mr. Carl Bildt, to discuss the book. And so it's not that they don't know about the situation and don't care, but I think it's just hard to know what would lead to something.
Well, at a minimum, it seems that delivering services to the subjects of the book, or at least the orphanages, seems to be a pretty practical, concrete way to go. I mean, the discussions that we had over several meetings in Europe, we came up with at least 49 things that Western governments could do. Some of those things only the Russian government can do, but I urge you to continue to press, because I think the response is to say, well, what can we on the outside do? And I think the answer is there are very specific things, everything from having contacts with universities and students and orphanages to helping support independent media and having journalists have contact with you young people on the ground. So,
Alex Van Os here. I want to say that I teach at the Foreign Service Institute. I'm not a Foreign Service officer. I'm not with the State Department. I'm just a private individual. I just got back from Russia and hadn't been there for a long time. And a couple of things. I call myself a humble student of the Caucasus and of Russia, because I'm always surprised by those places. And looking at films and so forth, the theme of the orphan seems to be a very important and powerful one in Russian films. The film The Italian, for example. There's a very strange documentary by a Dutch filmmaker a few years ago that suggests that Putin himself may have a very interesting background connected with the Caucasus and is not who we think he is. It's called Putin's Mama. Should look that up. And there are films like Crazy, was it, House of Fools, which is more about an insane asylum. But I think there you have a very powerful theme that could help groups of people understand each other and sympathize within Russia and so forth. The other thing I was thinking about, you said you had studied Russian literature a lot. And I gave a talk at the beginning of my classes about the Russian classics, Lermontov, Tolstoy, Pushkin, and all that, and how in the 1800s this sort of mythology about the Caucasus developed that had an influence on policy and making war and so forth, and perhaps still pertains. And I think in the United States we have our own little mythologies about other peoples. And I'm wondering how do you think is the best way to sort of get through these filters?
The filters of in Russia or...
Yeah, I think, for example, I worry about that we as Americans perhaps are creating our own filter about the Caucasus, and that it is a place where something must be done and we need to do it, and that that will just create more violence and harm for other people. Is there a more subtle way that can include all the parties?
Can I ask you, when you say the Caucasus, are you specifically speaking about Chechnya or Georgia? Or
I see the Caucasus as a region, including the North and the South Caucasus. I don't see them as separate.
So, yes, you are speaking in part about Georgia.
But when it comes to the U.S. government or Europe, also such last since August or before, it seems there's a different, very different approach, especially towards Georgia, I would maybe divide between the Northern Caucasus that is part of Russia and the neighboring Caucasus states. When it comes to our policy towards them, that we seem, I suppose also when it comes to the U.S. government, we tend to, or they tend to think that what's part of Russia, it's there. It's theirs. We don't mess with that. Let them do as they want. So I don't seem, it doesn't seem today that there is some kind of a hand who wants to do an action when it comes to the terrible breaches of human rights in Chechnya, in Ingushetia, in other northern Caucasian states. And then Georgia, of course, now very different. And there, I suppose, there's also a very different approach from the United States approach is different from the European approach. Like, at least from the Norwegian point of view, we were against granting NATO membership to Georgia and Ukraine, because for us in Norway, we are neighbors to Russia, and we need Russia to. We want Russia to be stable. We want to work with the Russians. We want to cooperate with the Russians. We want to trade with the Russians, as we have for hundreds of years. And we have a very stable, but very short border, 200 kilometers only. But still, we also, I think it's. When you say about this, the United States government wants to act, and we would, or when I say we, it seems like I speak for the Norwegian government.
Excuse me,
here.
No, I didn't. Yeah. I didn't mean the U.S. government. I mean we Americans have this tendency to want to go out and do good.
Yeah, but then I think that I would definitely criticize Russia for the human rights abuses, but I also see that to have a peaceful region, peaceful world, we also have to respect Russia's they call it the sphere of influence, the near abroad, the fact that they would feel very threatened by having so many NATO countries up to their borders, the missile shields, which might not be a very good idea if we really want stability in this region. So I'm kind of, in one way, I think that we should somehow also respect Russia more when it comes to these issues, and not just fight for the, I don't know if it's ideology that we want to expand NATO to how far as possible, or what's the reason for that, whether it's really well thought of when it comes to stable regions. But apart from that, this, your question is very, very broad, and it's more like a very big discussion. But I agree definitely. It's Tolstoy, who I read his part of his diaries when he was in his early 20s, fighting in around Chechnya, and I put one of his quotes in the book where he says. He asked himself, "War? Is it a good idea?" And he kind of answers, "No, it will always get the worst out of people and places." So it's like where he turned against violence already in his 20s. So it's a lot of interesting traditions there in literature.
Hello, I'd like to turn us to the issues of Islam as it's practiced today, because you've had a chance to see, you know, both the informal side of things in the orphanage and then the more formal versions of Kadyrov's, you know, biggest mosque in Europe as he's advertising it. So any insights you could give us into how things are playing out in terms of Muslim identity and sort of the battle for souls over Islam in Chechnya would be greatly appreciated.
Well, and also the comment about the headscarves. I've heard from professors at Moscow State as long as 2 years ago that Kadyrov was essentially paying $100. You could get $100 if you were wearing a headscarf, and then headscarves became mandatory. And that this is virtually not... I've never seen it published. You know, people don't discuss this aspect of it, either in the Russian press or in the West. Mm.
I don't think they got the money for it. I think that was something they said. At least I never heard of anyone. Everybody says, yeah, we heard they would get this. They would get, but nobody got the money. But he gave out for, as you know, 8th of March is a Women's Day. And in Russia you give gifts or flowers. And Kadyrov went to the university 8th of March, and he said to the women, I'll give you a gift to all the women students, and he gave them each a headscarf, and he said that he would be very sorry if they didn't wear it. So that's how that was being done. When it comes to Islam, definitely Kadyrov is very much playing up the role of religion. He wants to that Chechnya should be run by Muslim values, by Chechen traditions. Sometimes it's this, as you know, in Chechen religion, is sometimes a mix between traditions and Islam. And he wants to. He's had this big fight with a Wahhabist. With the important part, imported branch of Islam that came with the wars, with the fighters, with money from Middle East, and with the fighters being radicalized because of the war, and coming and building mosque, telling the Chechens what is the real Islam, and telling them that their way of believing was almost like heresy. They have mostly left, or those ideas are not allowed. To be a Wahhabist is the worst thing you can be in Chechnya, but you have to be a good Muslim. So it's very much taking it kind of back to the traditional Islam. And as we know, in the Soviet period, people were still believing, but they were not allowed to worship, and it was disappearing. Also, when it came to you have Chechens who drink, and it's not really they don't really, as I've experienced, it's not as strict as it would be in many Middle Eastern countries. Maybe, I don't know, we have a Chechen person here, so you might correct me if I'm wrong. I just talk from my own experience. But it's also in the orphanage, there's a very strict Islamic upbringing. Especially the boys, they have to pray five times a day, and for Hadijat, the mother of the orphanage, she explained to me that these are children who've grown up without any limits and without any upbringing or education, and it's important for them to they must learn about God, they must learn to pray, they must learn to respect our traditions, to at least have some guidelines that are equal for everybody. So there is quite strict teaching, but in addition to that, you would also have in the Chechen society today widespread. You have honor killings, which are widespread and increasing. And even as I heard, I haven't seen him saying that himself, but I've heard that Kadyrov has kind of approved of that. And honor killings are always towards women. Often it's a brother killing a sister. You have blood feuds, which is also more widespread as a traditional way of fixing up fights. And in the book, there's we discussed this honor killing, the issues, because it's really an issue that people tend to talk about, that neighbor, that relative, have you heard? You know, I understood that in this orphanage, the women who work in the orphanage, they all knew of someone or heard of someone or knew themselves. And I, at some point during the discussion one evening, I said, it was actually the evening before I would leave, and I said, you know, I'd really like to find such a brother who's killed his sister, just to understand what goes on and why he does it and whether there's any remorse. And Hadijat said, well, I can fix that for you. And I was like, well, I'm leaving tomorrow. I'm not allowed to leave this house. How can you fix that? And she left the table and she came back a few minutes after. And she said, I found you someone who's killed his sister. And we went up to her room, and there was one of the boys of the orphanage, one of the orphans, actually, who was now in his early 20s, because he got to the orphanage in 96, so when he was 10 or 12. He had killed his sister, and he told me the story probably just because Khadija told him to tell the story. And it was the typical story of a sister who he had heard there were some rumors that she had some boyfriends, and then their parents were killed. So he was kind of, even he was 3 years younger than her, he was the head of the family. And first he beat her up and threatened her, and she ran away. And the next time he goes and looks for her and sees her at the street corner. She was selling gasoline or something in a village. He found her in this village, and he said that they were going to meet some relatives. And she goes into the car, and he drives the car into a ditch, so that they have to go out and push it. And there he takes up his gun and he kills the sister and buries her. And he said he'd only told that story to the orphanage and to his wife. He was just married after the wedding, he told her. And they were just expecting a child, and I asked whether there was any regret, and he was just saying she asked for it. She knew that this would happen if she didn't behave, at some point, because I Hadija told me that you can meet him before I knew who he was, and he was the kindest person in the orphanage, a timid boy, very very. I had a very good impression of him. But she told me before going up the stairs to see him, and before saying who it was, she said, you can meet him on one condition, that you don't criticize him. So, which was good to know. I also had my guidelines. And of course, as a journalist, you shouldn't criticize the people you interview. But I asked him about, when I started to ask about how she looked like and things like that, then he started to cry, and it seemed to be, it was like the only time he'd actually cried over her. And he also said that, in the end, she haunted him at night. So that was the punishment. There's no punishment in Chechnya these days against these crimes, but there's eventually their own conscience. So that is part of the traditions that are not so nice, or according to maybe Western values, that are not so nice. But most of the people I met said, like, these women, and I would say they're quite ordinary, the women working at the orphanage would say, it's very sad, but we need to show how some limits to how women can behave. So they were actually supporting this. It's sad, but that's how it is. And about this boy, Hadijat said that if we'd known in advance, we would have advised him not to kill her. But now that he has killed her, we have to support him. So it's quite harsh.
My question is of a quite a different nature from these, but I've read all your books and I really appreciate them. But the settings are really different and quite dramatic. And I guess I'm just curious, how does one go home afterward and detach from these settings and do what one normally does, meet friends and spend time with family and just do very kind of mundane things? And how do you detach from all of these different settings?
I think that I have to see this as a job. So it's just a way of trying to be professional in a way. When I was younger, I wasn't able to do that. And I also explained, because I have a few chapters in the book about the First War and how, having covered, lived with fighters or their families in the villages, and every day you live like on the edge between life and death in a way, and every turn is important, like whether you go left or right, it's like it can define whether you will still be alive. And then coming back to Moscow, and just everything is grey, there's nothing, there's no importance to anything. I got depressed. It's like real life is that, where they're fighting for, you know, for freedom. Or so I was then I couldn't really divide my private life and my job. So I wanted to go down and report and live. So And then also other stories. I would come back to Norway, and I would, you know, the societies of consumerism, how we decorate our houses, how that's for Christmas, that's the main thing, is how we're going to decorate the house. And I was really angry at all these issues and how people didn't care and all spending their life in cozy surroundings. And but then now that I get older, first of all, I cannot change the world. Secondly, I'm very exhausted after having reported on something like this. And maybe this is probably the worst book I wrote, and worst day because of the children. When I come home, I can enjoy being at home, and that's their life, and this is my life that I don't it doesn't get mixed up. But I suppose this is also an issue for human rights workers. And I said something about this in an interview, and I got a phone call from or an email from a police officer who said that, you know, he really appreciated what I'd said about the divide, because they have the same thing, but they could have the same thing in one day. Like, they work from 8 till 4, maybe with the most terrible abuses or killings, and then they go back to their family at 4 o'clock, or doctors or psychiatrists. So I think there are... this is, of course, you see a lot, but there are lots of people, and they don't have the therapy of writing it down. So I think it's just about, this is my job, switch, finish, and then you live your own life. And I don't bring those destiny into my private life.
I mean, I think for the human rights movement in general, it's a problem. And different organizations have handled it in different ways. There's some organizations that have sabbaticals. It's very important that people get out of the field and into some place where they can restore. For a lot of human rights activists who have worked in Chechnya, it's been extremely difficult. And there are organizations that, that work to try and find them places to help repair psychologically, but also physically. Before we end, can you tell us a little bit about what your next project is and what you're thinking, or other than raising your newborn child, is there a next book project?
Well, it's I just got a child, so I think there's no more war zones for me. but there are lots of other stories to cover. That's not necessarily just on the front line. It could be behind the front line. And maybe my next project, I'm not sure, but it's I'm interested in also the Arabic world. And so as we're considering to go to Egypt, actually, and then I'll go with my family and see how the, actually, especially the youth, I'm interested in the young Arabs, how they are the one that will confront your new government, the future. So because when we see what do we hear from the Arabic world on TV, for instance, in papers, you usually see some angry guys who shout something, but is that how do people in these countries, what do they really think, how diverse is it, how different? So I'm considering to learn Arabic, but I think it's very tough, tougher than Russian, or at least just as tough. So I think that might be the same project, because we have a joint project with my husband there.
Before we end, are there any last questions? If there aren't, let me just ask one last question. When you were in and around Chechnya, did you have any sense of either UN presence or Danish Refugee Council or other sort of donors, or not at all? I mean, how much of an international presence did you see in Chechnya?
Well, I got that same question yesterday, and I'm not sure if I answered really correctly, because the way I was living there, mm-hmm. you know, I wasn't investigating anything. And so I was just living in this family or living then at this government compound. Mm-hmm. So I was not really interested either because it didn't fit into my book. So as I didn't investigate it, I also didn't see it. It was not apparent, because what you see in the streets, you all know, it's just posters of Kadyrov, so there were no real signs. But I did visit once the Red Cross, then I was on some semi-official visit as if I was a journalist, and that's why I was there. And I didn't write about it in the end, but I was going with a journalist from AFP, and there they had the microcredits that seemed quite good, and there were lots of women especially standing up in line. They would get money for a cow or for a sewing machine or for three sewing machines, small loans. That seemed, and I went to interview some of the people. There were also some Russian women there, Chechen women, and that seemed to be a good thing, because there's a great corruption in Chechnya, and money disappear, and they have to go into the Kadyrov Fund.
What are the sources of funding for the orphanage?
The sources for the orphanage is all foreign sources, and that's why it's not been closed down, because Kadyrov has closed down all state orphanages. He did that last year because he said Chechens, we don't have orphans in Chechnya, because all children have at least an extended family. So he just closed down all state orphanages, and of course some of these orphanages came to Hadijat's house, including some of the people working there. This orphanage could not be closed down because there was no funding for it from the state, so they couldn't take away the funding. So it is a German organization that sends the money every month. That's the most stable source of income. Then there's some donors, private donors. There is the Waldorf Schools Association, the Rudolf Steiner Schools. in Scandinavia and Germany, they have project. They have one of their projects is to support this specific orphanage. So they gather money, and then there's a Finnish woman who's bought them a house in Lithuania. So it's that kind of funding. So nothing from big organizations. So it's very much from day to day and from week to week.
One final question, yes.
It's not a question. It's just a suggestion, which is I would encourage you, if you haven't already, to think of this book also as a play or a film, not necessarily in documentary style, and that might reach new audiences. The stories are very powerful.
I think there's a trend in reportage of human rights abuse of trying to use a variety of different media in order to convey the message, rather than just having, you know, CSIS reports or Human Rights Watch reports, or that plays and movies are quite an effective way to reach an audience. So thank you for that suggestion.
Yeah, thank you. And then just also to finalize, that's also why, as I said in the middle of my talk, like, where's the angle? Like, what kind of book is this? That I have to think also, like, as a writer or an artist, if you like, because there's not a big cry out to, we need information about Chechnya in this world. Nobody would pick up the book because of the subject, really. But they would pick it up, well, of course, by recommendation if there were, but by the way it's written, or and that's why I start off in the middle of the action with this boy who's just killed that dog, so that it's kind of, I just want to go straight into the reader, so that people, even those who are not interested in Chechnya and who doesn't care about Chechnya, would want to keep on reading once they have the book in their hand. So it's I worked a lot on getting on the readability, or how to say it, to on the literary part of this book.
Thank you so much, Asne, and please join me in thanking her. I hope you come back.